Hare Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Vyandhara Bhavahai Tejasvi Navaditamastama Vidvisha Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna
Prabhupada's first and main instruction to his editors had been that they should produce the magazine regularly, every month. Even if they didn't know how to sell the copies, or even if they only turned out two pages, they had to continue bearing the standard. He called Hayagriva to his room and presented him a complete three-volume set of his Srimad Bhagavatam. On the front page of each volume he had written, "To Sriman Hayagriva Das Brahmachari, with my blessings, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami." Hayagriva was grateful and mentioned he had not been able to afford them. "That's all right," Prabhupada said. "Now you compile the Bhakta Godhead. Work sincerely and make it as big as Time magazine." Prabhupada wanted all his disciples to take part in it. "Don't be dull," he said. "Write something." He wanted to give his disciples back to Godhead for their own preaching. Brahmananda and Gargamuni took the first issues out that same night on bicycles, riding to every head shop on the Lower East Side, all the way to 14th Street, and as far west as the West Village, until they had distributed all 100 issues. This was an increase in the preaching. Now all his students could take part in the work, typing, editing, writing, assembling, selling. It was his preaching, of course, but he wasn't alone anymore. Over a short 4 months, the society expanded sufficiently to warrant larger quarters than the small Second Avenue storefront temple, stated the editorial in the second issue of Back to Godhead. Prabhupada had not abandoned his idea for a big building in New York City. Greenwich Village real estate was too expensive, and Midtown was out of the question. But Prabhupada still said he wanted to buy a building. It was difficult for his followers to think of Krishna consciousness as anything more than a Lower East Side movement, because who but the people of the Lower East Side would be interested in Krishna consciousness? And anyway, who had money to buy a building in Manhattan? But one day, Rabindra Sarup had happened to meet someone, a wealthy Jewish heir who was sympathetic toward youth movements, who agreed to loan Swamiji $5,000. Rabindra Sarup had arranged a loan, and Swamiji had designated the money as his building fund, to which he had gradually added another $5,000 that he had collected through incidental donations. But with suitable buildings starting at $100,000, even this sum seemed petty. Swamiji went with Brahmananda to look at a building on 6th Street that had previously been the Jewish Providential Bank. It had a large lobby with a mezzanine, marble floors, and the atmosphere of a temple. Brahmananda suggested that the vault area could be remodeled for use as a dormitory, and Swamiji considered the mezzanine for his own apartment. The large lobby, he said, could be used for kirtans and lectures. On leaving the building, however, Prabhupada noted that it was located on the corner by a bus stop. It could not be a good location. The Gaudiya Math branch at Bagh Bazar in Calcutta, he said, was also located at a bus stop, and the noisy engine of the buses as they started up created a disturbance. Prabhupada next looked at the temple Emmanuel, also on 6th Street on the Lower East Side. It was even larger than the bank building, and when some of Swamiji's disciples walked through the cavernous, empty rooms, they became bewildered to think how, even if they could get such a place, they would be able to manage or use it. He visited other places, one so neglected and in such poor repair that it looked as though it had been vandalized, and another in similar condition, filled with lumber stacked almost to the ceiling. He asked Rupanuga, who had accompanied him, what he thought. And Rupanuga said, too much time and money to fix it up. So they left. Swamiji returned to his room and went into the bathroom, where he washed his feet in the tub. He said that it was an Indian custom that after walking outside, you wash your feet. Right, so from that time, because I remember that was one of the unique things when he joined the temple, was that you washed your hands, your mouth, and your feet after everything. After you went outside, before you did any puja or cooking, after you went to the bathroom, after you ate. So it was a fairly standard thing. Right? So that's, you know, Prabhupada would figure out how to arrange it. So that's the point, is one has one's culture, one figures out how to organize it. When the devotees met Mr. Price, an elegantly dressed real estate agent, you have a handful of stars, Mr. Price told Brahmananda. You are incorporated as a tax-free religious organization. You have no idea how much money this will save. So many people have to vacate just because they can't pay their taxes. But someone up there is looking after you people, and I have just a place for you and your Swami. That someone up there is a reference to God. Right? Always go, you know, someone up there like that. So. Mr. Price showed Brahmananda a handsome 3-story building near St. Mark's Place. It was a good downtown location, just near the young people, yet in an area where the uptown people would feel safe. The floors were polished hardwood. All the doors were ornately hand-carved, and it had a large hall suitable for a temple. The Marquis de Lafayette had stayed there during his visit in 1824, a fact that added to the building's charm and prestige. One evening, Mr. Price visited Prabhupada up in his room. Prabhupada sitting on the floor behind his desk, and Mr. Price sitting on a metal folding chair. Mr. Price wore an elegant suit and a white dress shirt with cufflinks and starched cuffs. Cufflinks means on the shirt, like you have shirts and they have buttons. So instead of putting buttons, they have two holes and you put through, like, let's say some metal, buttons. They go through and then you have a on the back and then it closes. Opens so that, I mean, or words, say it closes so it won't fall out, and so it looks more fancy. His expensive dress, meticulously tanned face, and blonde hair, which some devotees thought was a wig, contrasted strangely with Swamiji's simplicity. Mr. Price kept referring to Swamiji as Your Excellency, and he expressed much appreciation of Swamiji's work. He spoke optimistically about how, through his connections, he hoped to save Prabhupada a lot of money and trouble and get him just the place he wanted. Accompanied by a few disciples, Prabhupada went with Mr. Price to see the building. While Mr. Price, the devotees, and the custodian of the house were all talking together in a group, Prabhupada wandered off unnoticed to a corner of the room where there was an old-fashioned sewing machine. He began pressing the treadle and examining the workings of the machine. Treadle means that there's like a flat plate underneath that you put your feet and you move it back and forth, and that actually powers the machine. As Prabhupada rejoined the group, Mr. Price said, If you can just get $5,000 down, I can get the owners to draw up a contract. $5,000 down and another $5,000 within 2 months. That shouldn't be so difficult. Prabhupada liked the building and told Brahmananda they should purchase it. Brahmananda was inclined to turn the money over right away, but Prabhupada said that first a suitable contract had to be drawn up. Mr. Price talked to the devotees in private, speaking in the Swami's interest and in the interest of the spiritual movement, and he seemed to be promising them something even more than a contract. Perhaps he would give them the building. It didn't make sense that he could give the building, but he told them something like that. He wanted the devotees to think of him as their friend, and he invited them over to his house one evening. When the devotees gathered in his house, sitting stiffly on chairs in his living room, which was lined with bookcases filled not with books, but with two-dimensional designs depicting rows of books, he continued to flatter them. He praised Hayagriva's writings, and Hayagriva was obviously embarrassed and flattered. He praised everything about the devotees. He also spoke of how his dog had recently died and said, "The house seems empty without the little fellow." He was an unusual man, effeminate and full of flattery and praises. Prabhupada remained reserved after his first meeting with Mr. Price, though he was interested in getting the building if the proper arrangement could be made. Proper arrangement means the proper contract, so you know what's happening. Brahmananda continued to negotiate with Mr. Price, and soon, according to Mr. Price, the owners of the building would be expecting the devotees to give proof of their ability to meet the payments. On Prabhupada's direction, the devotees hired a lawyer to go over the contract. "This Mr. Price is causing us so much pain," Prabhupada said. "What is the difficulty?" He didn't see the necessity for Mr. Price at all. "Why don't we purchase directly from the owners? Why all these agents?" "It's just the way it's done here," Brahmananda said. Alan Coleman was a record producer. He had read the article in the East Village Other about the Swami from India and the mantra he had brought with him. When he had read the Hare Krishna mantra on the front page, he had become attracted. The article gave the idea that one could get a tremendous high or ecstasy from chanting. The Swami's Second Avenue address was given in the article, so one night in November, Alan and his wife visited the storefront. Alan. "There were 30 pairs of shoes in the back of the room. People in the front and shoes in the back. We took off our shoes and sat down. Everyone was seated and very quiet. Front and center was a chair, and everyone was staring at this chair. Even then, we felt a certain energy in the room. No one was saying anything, and everyone is staring at the chair. The next thing was our first sight of the Swami. He came in and sat down on the chair, and there was a tremendous surge of energy. The Swami began chanting. It was a very beautiful sound. Swamiji had this little drum he was hitting, very penetrating and exciting. One of the devotees was holding up a sign with a chant written on it so everyone could follow. Then the devotees got up and danced in a circle, a special dance with steps to it. The Swami was looking around the room, and he seemed to smile as he looked at you, as if to encourage you to join. The next day, Alan phoned Prabhupada to propose that he make a record of the chanting. But it was Brahmananda who answered the phone and gave Alan an appointment with the Swami that evening. So again, Alan and his wife went down to the East Village, which to them was the neighborhood where things were happening. If you wanted to have some excitement, you went down to the East Village. Then, when he entered the Swami's room, he was seated at his typewriter, working. As soon as Alan mentioned his idea about making a record, Prabhupada was interested. "Yes," he said, "we must record. If it will help us distribute the chanting of Hare Krishna, then it is our duty." So Prabhupada is saying, if it's some way to expand the mission, then it's something that we should do. Right? Not just something we could do, but no, if it expands the mission, then it's something we should do. Right? Yes? They scheduled the recording for 2 weeks later, in December, at the Adelphi recording studio near Times Square. Alan's wife was impressed by how enthusiastically the Swami had gotten to the point of making the record. Quote, he had so much energy and ambition in his plans. It was the night before the recording date. A boy walked into the storefront for the evening kirtan carrying a large two-headed Indian drum. This was not unusual, as guests often brought drums, flutes, and other instruments. Yet this time Swamiji seemed particularly interested. The boy sat down and was preparing to play when Prabhupada motioned for the boy to bring him the drum. The boy didn't move. He wanted to play it himself, but Brahmananda went over and said, Swami wants to play the drum. Right? So the boy gave in. Right? We have to remember, Brahmananda is very big and very assertive. Right? Brahmananda. Swami began to play, and his hands were just dancing on the drum. Everyone was stunned that Swami knew how to do this. We had all we had seen was the bongo drum, so I thought it was the proper Indian drum. But when this two-headed drum came out of nowhere and Swamiji started playing it like a master musician, it created an ecstasy 100 times more than the bongo drum had. After the kirtan, Prabhupada asked the boy if he could borrow the drum for the recording session the next day. The boy at first was reluctant, but the devotees promised to return his drum the next day. So he agreed and said he would bring the drum the next evening. When he left the storefront that night with the drum under his arm, the devotees thought they would never see the boy or his drum again. But the next day, a few hours before Swamiji was to leave for the studio, the boy returned with his drum. It was a cold December night. The Swami, dressed in his usual saffron dhoti, a tweed overcoat and a pair of gray shoes, which had long since replaced his original white pointy rubber ones, got into Rupanuga's VW van with about 15 of his followers and their instruments and started for the recording studio. Tweed overcoat. Tweed is a kind of, I think it's a kind of weave, but it's also a kind of a pattern that the threads are multicolored like that, so they don't... It's very strong, and it also doesn't get affected much by whatever it bumps into in the way of getting stained or discolored. Maybe we should get tweed cheddars for all these guys. Brahmananda, we didn't start recording right away because there was a group ahead of us. So we went out for a walk in Times Square. We were just standing there with Swami, seeing all the flashing lights and all the sense gratification, when a woman came up to Swamiji and said, oh, hello, where do you come from? In a very loud matronly way. And Swamiji said, I am a monk from India. And she said, oh, that's wonderful. Glad to meet you. And then she took Swamiji's hand and left. Oh, she shook Swamiji's hand and left. At the studio, everyone except me, so matronly, kind of means like a motherly kind of elderly way. So, you know, very friendly, very pleasant, but, you know, that's all. Just nice to meet you. At the studio, everyone accepted the devotees as a regular music group. One of the rock musicians asked them what the name of their group was, and Hayagriva laughed and replied, the Hare Krishna Chanters. Of course, most of the devotees weren't actually musicians, and yet the instruments they brought with them, a tambourine, a large harmonium loaned by Allen Ginsberg, and rhythm instruments, were ones they had played during kirtans for months. So as they entered the studio, they felt confident that they could produce their own sound. They just followed their Swami. He knew how to play, and they knew how to follow him. They weren't just another music group. It was music, but it was also chanting, meditation, worship. Right? Because the idea is that each music group is there, have their unique sound that sets them apart. Right? So devotees are obviously unique. And so then in this, everyone's confident. They feel they're part of this band, they can do. So then the devotees, you know, didn't look, insecure or anything. So then the other bands that were there, then they consider they must be, you know, a regular band that knows what they're doing. Prabhupada sat on a mat in the center of the studio while the engineers arranged the microphones and assigned each devotee a place to sit according to his particular instrument. So the point is if one's confident, one knows what one's doing, you know, which comes, as we said here, by practice. The devotees have been doing this for months, so they had practice. So if by practice you know how to do something, you're confident, people will accept it. Right? That's the basic principle. If you think, oh no, it's different from them, strange. People aren't worried about different and strange. They're worried about confidence. If you're confident, you're comfortable, you know how to do what you do, people accept. Right? They don't get distracted and think, because everybody's different from everybody else anyway. Everybody's trying to be different from anybody else anyway. Right? Make sense? So that's not actually a problem. It's that one is confident. Yes, you know, the devotional activities, the preaching, the lifestyle, this is what we do. Then it becomes nice. Yes?
Yes.
No?
Yes.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes, not no. No, no, no. So no, two no's make a yes.
No.
No. So two no's means no.
One yes means a yes.
One yes means a yes. And? Two no's?
No, don't make anything.
Two no's make nothing. Okay, and what about two yeses?
They also don't make anything.
Okay, two yeses don't make anything. So if I come up to you and say, so you want more sweets, and then you go, yes, yes, then I'm supposed to say, oh, that means nothing, and just go on.
No.
No. Okay, so one no means no. Yes. That was one yes, so that confirms it. No or yes?
Yes.
Very good. The studio people, they asked for only two pairs of kartals, and they approved of the pairs of rhythmic sticks, but they wanted several devotees clapping their hands. Rupanuga's unusual instrument was a pair of brass Indian bells with the tongues removed, and when the engineer saw them, he came over and said, let me hear that. Rupanuga played them, and they passed. Right, because they have to balance all the sounds, otherwise something's too loud, then it'll overpower. So they're trying to get all the sounds very clear and get the maximum amount of variety. Since Rabindra Swarup would be playing the drone on the harmonium, he sat apart with his own microphone. And Kirtananda also had a microphone for the tambourine. When the engineers were satisfied, they cued the devotees, and Swamiji began chanting and playing his drum. The cymbals and sticks and clapping hands joined in, and the chanting went on steadily for about 10 minutes, until an engineer came out of the glass studio and stopped them. Brahmananda was clapping too loudly, creating an imbalance. The engineer went back into his studio, put on his headphones, balanced everyone, and cued them for a second take. This time it was better. Right, Q means, you know, now you start. Okay. The first sound was the tambourine with its plucked reverberating twang. Oh, tambura, not tambourine. Playing the drone. Yeah, no, it's a tambura. Kirtananda was playing the tambura, not tambourine. Okay. The first sound was the tambura with its plucked, reverberating twang. In the Indian classical tradition, the tambura is always first. It's the first to start and the last to finish. Right? So it starts up because from that you get your tone. And then when you finish singing, then it's the last thing, then it finishes. It also represents what's called in Sanskrit nod. Nod means the primordial sound, the original sound, right? It means the sound on which everything else is based. So that nod, then that is represented also in the first chakra, right? In the chakra system. And then from there, the sound comes up through the chakras until it hits the fifth chakra, which is then where the voice is. Then you actually hear the sound. But the sound started at nod. So the tambura represents nod, so it's always the first sound, right? So it comes from nod, goes back to nod, right? So very esoteric. What do you think? Yes? Okay. An instant later, Swamiji began beating the drum and singing, Vande Ham Shri Guru. Then the whole assembly put out to sea. The tambura, the harmonium, the clackers, the cymbals, Rupanuga's bells, Swamiji's solo singing, pushed off from their moorings. Out into a fair weather sea of chanting. Lalita Sri Vishakhanvitams Cha. Swamiji's voice in the studio was very sweet. His boys were feeling love, not just making a recording. There was a feeling of success and union. A crowning evening to all their months together. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda. After a few minutes of singing prayers alone, Swamiji paused briefly while the instruments continued pulsing, and then began the mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. It was pure Bhaktivedanta Swami, expert, just like his cooking in the kitchen, just like his lectures. The engineers liked what they heard. It would be a good take if nothing went wrong. The instruments were all right. The drum, the singing, the harmonium was rough. But this was a special record, a happening. The Hare Krishna chanters were doing their thing, and they were doing it all right. Alan Coleman was excited. Here was an authentic sound. Maybe it would sell. Harmonium was rough because they only have a drum, so drone, so they don't play the keyboards. They just take one of the springs off of whichever note they want or notes, so it's always permanently on, and then they just play. But they'll pump, and so the sound will go according to the pump. So the sound of the harmonic go wow 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 like that, because they won't pump evenly. You know, they just like this. So that's why it says that it was a little rough. After a few rounds of the mantra, the devotees began to feel relaxed, as though they were back in the temple. And they were able to forget about making mistakes on the record. They just chanted. And the beat steadied into a slightly faster pace. The word Hare would come sometimes with a little shout in it, but there were no emotional theatrics in the chorus, just the straight response to the Swami's melody. 10 minutes went by, the chanting went faster, louder and faster, Swamiji doing more fancy things on the drum, until suddenly everything stopped, with the droning note of the harmonium lingering. Alan came out of the studio. It was great, Swami, great. Would you like to just go right ahead and read the address now? Or are you too tired? With polite concern, pale, befreckled Alan Coleman peered through his thick glasses at the Swami. Swami appeared tired, but he replied, "No, I am not tired." Then the devotees sat back in the studio to watch and listen as Prabhupada read his prepared statement. What's befreckled?
Befreckled? Freckles means when you have a bunch of spots. It means they're coloring like that, but there's so many of them, right? They're really noticeable. You know, if you have a couple of them, it's not. But when you have tons of them, then you're freckled like that. So it's a, you see it sometimes.
As Swami explained, as explained on the cover of the record album, the sympathetic devotees thought that Swamiji, despite his accent, sounded perfectly clear, reading from his script like an elocutionist. Elocutionist is someone who says things very clear. This transcendental vibration of chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, is the sublime method for reviving our Krishna consciousness. The language was philosophic, and the kind of people who usually walked out of the temple as soon as the kirtan ended, before the Swami could speak even a word, would also not appreciate the speech on their record album. As living spirit souls, Swamiji preached, we are all originally Krishna conscious entities. But due to our association with matter from time immemorial, our consciousness is now polluted by material atmosphere. The devotees listened submissively to the words of their spiritual master, while at the time trying to comprehend the effect this would have on the audience. Certainly some people would turn it off at the very mention of a spiritual nature. Swamiji continued reading, explaining that the chanting would deliver one from the sensual, the mental, and the intellectual planes and bring one to the spiritual realm. We have seen it practically, he continued. Even a child can take part in the chanting, or even a dog can take part. The chanting should be heard, however, from the lips of a pure devotee of the Lord. And he continued reading on to the end. No other means, therefore, of spiritual realization is as effective in this age as chanting the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Alan again came rushing out of the studio. It was fine, he said. He explained that they had recorded a little echo into the speech to make it special for the listener. Now, he pushed back his glasses with his finger. We've got about 10 minutes left on the side with the speech. Would you like to chant again? Or is it too late, Swamiji? Prabhupada smiled. No, it was not too late. He would chant the prayers to his spiritual master. While his disciples lounged around the studio, watching the spiritual master and the technical activity of the engineers behind the glass, Prabhupada began singing. Again, the harmonium's drone began, then the tambura and drum, but with a much smaller rhythm group than before. He sang through without any retakes, and then ended the song and the evening with a fortissimo drumming as the hand pumped organ notes faded away. Fortissimo means quick, right?
Very strong.
Okay. Oh, okay. So it's more means like forceful. That would be fortissimo. Okay.
Again, Alan came out and thanked the Swami for being so patient and such a good studio musician. Prabhupada was still sitting. Now we are tired, he admitted. Suddenly, over the studio's sound system came a playback of the Hare Krishna chanting, complete with echo. When Prabhupada heard of the successful recording of his chanting, he became happy and stood and began dancing, swaying back and forth. Dipping slightly from the waist, his arms upraised in the style of Lord Chaitanya, dancing in ecstasy. The scheduled performance was over, but now Swamiji was making the best performance of the evening from his spontaneous feelings. As he danced, his half-asleep disciples became startled and also rose to their feet and joined him, dancing in the same style. Hmm. and in the recording booth behind the glass. The engineers also raised their hands and began dancing and chanting. "Now you have made your best record," Swamiji told Kalman, Mr. Kalman, as he left the studio for the freezing Manhattan evening. Swamiji got into the front seat of the Volkswagen bus while the Hare Krishna chanters climbed into the back with their instruments. And Rupa Nuga drove them back home, back to the Lower East Side. The next morning, Prabhupada didn't get up. He was exhausted. Kirtanananda, who was personally serving him, became alarmed when the Swami said something about his heart skipping and about not being able to move. For the first time, it became apparent that he was overexerting himself. Kirtanananda thought back through the fall and the summer, when the Swamiji had led them on hour-long kirtans in the park or on late evening ventures. They had come to take it for granted, but now Kirtanananda saw that there was cause to be worried for Swamiji's health. Swamiji had no appetite for lunch, although by afternoon he regained his appetite and usual activity. The same day, a letter arrived from Mukunda in San Francisco. Not long after their wedding, Mukunda and Janaki had left for the West Coast. Mukunda had told Swamiji that he wanted to go to India to study Indian music, but after a few weeks in Southern Oregon, he had ended up in San Francisco. Now he had a better idea. He wanted to rent a place and invite Swamiji to come and start his Hare Krishna movement in the Haight-Ashbury district, just as he was doing on the Lower East Side. Oh, okay, yeah, because it said, I think Janaki and, right, Janaki's sister, they were from Oregon, so. He had a better idea. He wanted to rent a place and invite Swamiji to come and start his Hare Krishna movement in the Haight-Ashbury district, just as he was doing on the Lower East Side. He said that the prospects there for Krishna consciousness were very good. On hearing this, Prabhupada began unfolding his expansive plans. They should open temples not only in San Francisco, but one by one, all over the world, even in Russia and China, and print the Bhagavad Gita in different languages. And he would translate all the volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam into English and take a party of devotees back to India. The devotees who heard him were amazed. Kirtanananda, who had seen the alarming symptoms of Prabhupada's ill health, began to forget what he had thought earlier that morning. If Krishna desired, Kirtanananda thought, Swamiji could do anything. Right? Because the Haight-Ashbury district, that was similar like the Lower East Side, just on the western coast, the exact other side of America. And there you had the same kind of scene where all the young people were congregating there and, you know, doing same kind of activities. But, you know, it was the West Coast, so it has slightly different flavor like that. That was the, yeah. I think the West Coast, they were known as the dirty hippies. I'm not sure why. I kind of think they were all a bit dirty, but, you know, like that, maybe they were more dirty. They were a little bit more wild in how they dressed, I think. When Prabhupada came down to hold his morning class on November 19th, he carried a large red book instead of the usual brown one, but no one noticed the difference. He began, as always, softly singing prayers to his spiritual master and accompanying himself with a faint rhythm on his bongo. The neighbors were still asleep. The weather was cold, but the steam radiators kept the storefront warm. There would be no more outdoor chanting now. In Manhattan, the city opens wide in the summer and shuts tight in the winter, which for the evening classes meant no more noisy children outside the door. And although the morning class had always been quiet, even in the summer, now with winter approaching, the group became a tighter, more committed core of sincere students coming together to hear Swamiji speak. It was now 4 months since he had begun ISKCON at 26 Second Avenue. He had held 3 separate initiations and initiated 19 devotees. Most of them had become serious, although a few remained casual visitors. Now, in these morning classes, Swamiji wanted to instruct them more about how to become devotees. He led the chanting of Hare Krishna for 20 minutes, cautioning them to respond softly so that the neighbors would not pour water through the ceiling again. So it must mean that there's cracks in the floor, so they just pour a bunch of water and then it drips down. Yes, that's New York, right? Yes. Although they hadn't done it lately, Prabhupada always tried to cooperate with the tenants, but occasionally someone would start a petition, which never amounted to much, against the devotees. Sometimes Prabhupada would help the landlord, Mr. Chuti, by taking out other tenants' garbage or just giving him a hand. Mr. Chuti was a husky, beer-bellied Polish refugee who lived alone in an apartment on the first floor. Any Poles here? No Poles. Okay. He's next door. Chutey. Polish. No idea. Say it, Chuti. Chutty, cootie. This guy's got cooties. Mr. Chuti respected the Swami for his age and scholarship, and Swami was always amiable with him. Whenever Mr. Chuti came to the apartment, he would never take his shoes off. And Prabhupada would say, "That's all right, that's all right." And one time, when the plumbing didn't work in Prabhupada's apartment, Prabhupada went downstairs and took a shower in Mr. Chuti's apartment. But Swamiji also considered Mr. Chuti a classic example of a foolish materialist, right? A muda, right? Because although he had spent his life savings to buy this building, he still had to work so hard. Swamiji said he was a fool for having spent his savings to buy such a run-down building. Because the building was in such poor condition, he had to work like an ass to keep it up. Quote, "This is how the materialists work," Swamiji would say. Mr. Chuti, although respectful to the Swami, didn't like the devotees. Prabhupada told his disciples, "Treat him as if he were your father." So that's what they did. Anytime they would have to deal with Mr. Chuti, they would approach him saying, "We are your sons." Those disciples who lived in the storefront had risen by 6:30, bathed, and assembled downstairs by 7, while those who lived outside were arriving separately, taking off their coats and piling them on the shelf of the display window. Although women always attended the evening meetings, Jadarani was usually the only girl who came in the morning. After breakfast, she would begin painting upstairs in the Swami's front room. She used a beginner's technique of dividing the canvas into vertical and horizontal grid lines and transposing bit by bit the corresponding sections of a photograph onto the canvas. The process was painstaking, and sometimes her painting was out of proportion. But Jadarani was sincere, and that pleased Prabhupada. She had completed several paintings of four-arm Vishnu, a new painting of Radha Krishna, and a painting of Lord Chaitanya and his associates. When the painting of Lord Chaitanya was finished, Swamiji had it hung in the temple. Now, he announced, there should be no more nonsense here. Lord Chaitanya is present. After the morning kirtan, Swamiji said, as usual, "Now chant one round." They chanted together, following him. They all had a vow to chant 16 rounds daily, but they chanted their first round in the morning in the Swami's presence, so he could see each of them. As Swamiji chanted, he looked out at Second Avenue, which was mostly deserted, or at the pictures of the wall, or with concerned glances at the individual devotees. Sometimes he seemed surprised when he saw them chanting so earnestly, giving evidence of the power of the holy name to deliver even the most fallen. Some of the devotees kept their beads in a bead bag like him. But when they chanted the first round together in the morning, they imitated him by holding their beads out in both hands and chanting along with him. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, until they finished one round. Then he held up the unfamiliar red book. Because you are a little advanced, he said, I am going to read today from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Chaitanya what? No one was able to pick up the pronunciation. They had heard of Chaitanya, certainly, but not of this new book. But in his room the night before, Prabhupada had informed some of the devotees he would start reading from a new book, Chaitanya Charitamrita. He said that Lord Chaitanya had told one of his disciples that understanding Krishna wasn't really possible, but that he would give the disciple just a drop of the ocean of Krishna consciousness, so that the disciple could then appreciate what the whole ocean must be like. Quote, be patient as I present this, he had told them. It is revolutionary, but you should just be patient. In the storefront, Brahmananda turned on the reel-to-reel tape recorder as Swamiji began reading the Bengali verses. And both Satsarup and Umapati opened their notebooks and waited, poised for rapid note-taking. It was almost a college classroom atmosphere as Prabhupada cleared his throat, put on his eyeglasses, and peered over the large open volume, turning to the correct page. Whenever he wore the glasses, he seemed to reveal a new personality of deep Vaishnav scholarship. This feature of Swamiji emphasized his old age. Not that it showed him feeble or an invalid, but it emphasized his scholarship and wisdom and his contemplation of the scriptures, in contrast to his vigorous drum playing in Tompkins Square Park or his alert business dealings while looking for a new building. That's the interesting thing. If you notice in any of the in Prabhupada's pictures, each one is uniquely different. Like that. There's something that's always special. Generally, if you see a article on a particular individual, and they have so many pictures, but in all the pictures, the person actually looks the same, mood, even though he may be in different situations or different dress, but the mood's the same. But with Prabhupada, each picture, the mood is different from every other picture. So they would say it's like when Prabhupada put on his glasses, then it would give completely one mood, or when he's doing kirtan, another mood, or when he was talking business, another mood. So whatever he was doing, he was completely doing that. And so that's what made it very special, very unique. Yes. Yeah, so Prabhupada's trying to get them to follow this lifestyle. He's establishing a lifestyle for them and activities. But at the same time, they're supposed to be natural, right? It's just something that they do. Right? Like they do the kirtan and all that as their regular lifestyle. But at the same time, is professional enough they can go and record. So that would be the principle, is that what you do, you practice it over and over again. Right? So it's not that like what you learn in the school. Much of the activities, you know, in a very short time you can learn how to do them. But to come to the point where it becomes part of your lifestyle so that you're actually very expert at it, you have the right attitude and mood, that takes years and years of doing. So that's what's unique about the Vedic education, is you do this all the time, so therefore that becomes a natural lifestyle. Yes? No? Maybe? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, very good. Confirmed. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nita Gaura Premanandi.